The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Protector of Israel, The Life and Times of Rabbi Yosselman of Rosheim, is dedicated to the memory of Moshe ben Eliyahu HaKoyen, the Gittel Bas Avrom, Aleihem HaShalom, Dr. and Mrs. Moses and Gertrude Hartman of blessed memory, and to the memory of Avrom ben Shmuel HaLevi, Olav HaShalom, Mr. Abraham Geyer of blessed memory.
Yaakov Avinu, the patriarch Jacob, was about to see his brother Esav after a period of over 30 years. Fearing the worst, he prayed, Hatzileni no miyad ochi miyad Esav. Save me, I beseech you, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. Rav Yosef Duber HaLevi Soloveitchik, the author of the Beis HaLevi, asked the following question. Why was it necessary for Yaakov to express this prayer in a redundant form? From the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. It should have been sufficient to have either described him as my brother or Esav. After all, Yaakov only had one brother. The Beis HaLevi answered that actually Yaakov was praying for two distinct needs. He wasn't sure if Esav was coming to him as a brother and would show him brotherly love, and that is the expression, miyad ochi, from the hand of my brother, or he would be coming to him as Esav would normally come, as an adversary, miyad Esav. Either way, Yaakov was fearful. If Esav would be coming as a brother, there was the fear of assimilation and of becoming submerged in the antithetical culture of Esav. With that, the whole uniqueness of Yaakov as a perpetuator of the traditions and values of the patriarchs, Avram and Yitzchok, would cease to exist. On the other hand, if Esav would be coming to him as Esav would normally come, as an adversary, there was physical danger, as the verse goes on to explain, for I fear him lest he will come and strike me and the mother with the children. This is the meaning, then, of the dual expression, Hatzileni no miyad ochi, miyad Esav. Save me, I beseech you, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. In every facet of our encounter with Esav, we are at risk. According to Talmudic tradition, the Romans are at least partially descended from Esav. This is also true of the Germans. And the same dual risk to Yaakov that existed then continues to exist with his descendants even today. That period of the Middle Ages most closely relating to that aspect of Ochi, my brother, was probably at its very end, the period between the 14th and the 16th century that is called the Renaissance, or rebirth. It was a time that is associated with a desire to return to the art and philosophy of the ancient pagan Greek and Roman world and to find good and intrinsic worth outside the world of Christianity. During that period, there was a rebirth in art and architecture based on classic ancient forms. This was felt most keenly in Italy. It was also an age that fostered an educational and philosophical outlook that emphasized the personal worth of the individual and the central importance of human values as opposed to religious belief. This philosophy is called humanism. As one of its leading proponents, the great Dutch humanist Desiderius Erasmus explained, it was an era which, quote, placed man in the center of the world so that he may freely look around all sides and choose his own position in it, end quote. The era's newfound curiosity with their classic roots also sparked an interest in the original language of the Bible, Hebrew. According to one historian, the climax of this Hebrew revival amongst Gentile scholars was reached when Pico della Mirandola, one of the most unusual persons in this very unusual age, purchased by chance a copy of the Zohar, the classic text of Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah, and became convinced that in the Jewish Kabbalah lies the truth of existence and even confirmation of the Christian faith. He became the founder of the Christian school of Kabbalah. The one who first introduced Pico della Mirandola to Jewish studies was Rav Eliyahu del Madigo, himself a unique individual. A native of Crete who moved to Venice, Rav del Madigo was very close to the leading figures of the Venetian Renaissance, including Marsilio Fenicio, the famous Neoplatonist. Another leading figure of that age was the German humanist Johannes Reuchlin. He lived between 1455 and 1522. In 1491, Pico della Mirandola met Reuchlin in Florence, Italy, where he had an enormous influence over Reuchlin. The next year, Reuchlin was at the royal court of the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick III, at Linz, Austria, where he met the emperor's personal physician, Jakob Jechiel Loans, a man to whom the emperor personally bestowed the title of knighthood. It was Loans who taught Reuchlin the rudiments of the Hebrew language. He also made an indelible impression on him. It was the first time that he ever met a Jew with such broad education, intelligence, and dignity. For Reuchlin, it broke the stereotypical image of the Jew forever. Between the years 1498 and 1500, Reuchlin was in Rome serving as ambassador to the Count Palatine, one of the seven electors of the Holy Roman Emperor. There, Reuchlin became associated with several Jews, above all the physician, scholar, biblical commentator, and Talmudic sage, Rav Avadia Sforno, who eventually became the head of the Jewish community in Rome. It was through Rav Sforno, he's called also Sforno, that Reuchlin developed a profound knowledge of Jewish literature. Reuchlin played an important role in the history of German Jewry, as we will soon see. Despite the efforts of the mendicant friars, the Dominicans and Franciscans, such as John Capistrano, Fra Bernardino de Feltre, and their ilk, Jews began to be accepted in the highest echelons of Italian society. At this time, however, the problem of Esav being Ochi, my brother, began to crop up. Jewish society started to become infected with the vices of their neighbors. Card playing and gambling seems to become part of Jewish life. In the words of one historian of that period, quote, "There was no other time and no other place in which amorous offenses made their appearance in Jewish life to the extent that they made in 15th century Florence, where out of 80 cases tried before civic magistrates at this time, 17 were for gambling and 34 for moral misdemeanors. There was no other time and no other place in which the establishment of a disorderly house in the Jewish quarter," this is a Bezonis, "could ever been discussed. There was no other time and no other place in which rabbis could have invoked, quote, Chas Diana, end quote, in their sermons." This was imagery based on a pagan theme that was common in Renaissance Italy. Diana, of course, was one of the pagan deities. "There was no other time and no other place where erotic poetry in Hebrew could have presented a problem that moralists had to address," end quote. This is only a partial quote. The historian went on and on with further examples. The Talmud describes the study of Torah, especially Talmud in great depth, as the most powerful antidote for the evil inclination, for the Yetzer Hara. Italy in that time of moral ambiguity was also blessed with some of the world's greatest Talmudic authorities, who established yeshivas and countless disciples. Probably the most outstanding of them was Rav Yosef Cologne, commonly known as the Ma'arik. The name Cologne, even though it has been suggested its origin relates to the city of Cologne, Germany, actually means dove. So does the word Columbus, its Latinized form. In fact, the notary records of 1475, which we quote as the first quote on the first page of the lecture notes, has the Ma'arik is Moreno Harav, says of Yosef Cologne. It's called Yosef Columbus. Was he related to Christopher Columbus? That is a possibility, and we discussed it in the previous lecture. In paragraph B, Number two, we quote a response that Rav Yosef wrote to Rav Yehuda, Rav Yechiel, the rabbi of Mantua, known as Messer Leon. We'll soon discuss him in greater length. In it is clear that Rav Yosef refers to him as the dove, in contradistinction to Rav Yehuda, known as Gur Aryeh, the lion. The Marik's father's name was Rav Shlomo Tarbot, as we see in B1, which probably refers to the name of the city of his origin. The Marik himself was born in the year 1410 in Cambrai in Savoy, northern Italy, which was then considered to be part of France, where he lived in his early years, and he always considered himself to be a Frenchman, not an Italian. And we see in number three, he refers to himself as a Frenchman. We do not know how old he was when he moved to Italy, but apparently he was old enough that he still recalled an incident in his early days that related to an issue that was discussed in one of his responses, so that's on top of page two. It was while he was still in Cambrai that he met and possibly studied under Rav Yaakov Levi, who is commonly identified as the Maharil, who we discussed in length in the previous lecture, the leading scholar at that time in all of Europe. It would also seem, this we have in number five, also seem that he studied under his father and refers to with the greatest of reverence, and that's on number six. In Italy, the Marik initially eked out a living as a school teacher for young children. He was a Rebbe and a Cheder. Despite the demands on his time and his poor economic situation, the Marik developed at that time into the greatest scholar in all of Italy, if not the world, and was sent Shalos questions from all corners of Italy. After being in several Italian communities, Piedmont, Bologna, Maestra, eventually settled in Mantua, where he enjoyed cordial relations with Yehuda Messer Leon. In paragraph C1, we quote a response in which the Marik defends the stance of Yehuda in allowing Jewish doctors to wear the special robes that were worn by Christian doctors, which would seem to be a sign of the times. Unlike the Marik, who identified himself with the French and German schools, who totally devoted themselves to the study of Talmud, Messer Leon was a prime example of the typical Italian scholar that Renaissance Italy produced. He was a philosopher and physician who, in recognition of his great talents, was called Messer, or Maestro, which means master. He wrote a work on grammar called Livnas HaSapir, and a book on the art of rhetoric called Neufes Tzufim. In fact, Neufes Tzufim was the very first Hebrew book ever published by a living author. As Rashi was published, but there were other, Chumash was published in Hebrew. But the very first book that was published through the printing presses in the time, this is the printing had just come out, of a living author was this Rav Yehuda Messer Leon in his Neufes Tzufim. He also wrote works on philosophy and medicine. In addition, he was also an outstanding Talmudic scholar. There's a story recording the Shalshelis HaKabbalah, which we quote in C2, on page 2. And this is describing the review. Yehuda was called Messer Leon, lived in the city of Mantua, Italy. He composed the work Neufes Tzufim and was an adversary of the Maharik. I mean, up until now, we find only the Maharik defending him. The community became so involved in the controversy that the Duke of Mantua expelled both of them from the city. Some historians want to attribute the friction between them as part of the general friction of the Torah-only school of the Maharik and the Renaissance general study school of Rav Yehuda Messer Leon. Other historians have pointed out, though, that there's absolutely no historical basis to support this story. All known documentation points to very cordial relations, and in fact, years later, Rav Yehuda's grandson often quoted the Maharik. The author of the Shalshelis HaKabbalah, who lived long after these purported events, was, as the Chidah and many other historians have pointed out, an uncritical compiler of documents who often took legends and unsubstantiated reports at face value. This is what the Maharik himself wrote about such things in general, on C3, which is on top of page 3. Throughout my entire life, I have distanced myself from being in the midst of harshness, of a controversy, especially when it meant to excommunicate one of the parties. As anyone who knows me can verify, this is not a course of action I would desire to take. Notwithstanding his avoidance of controversy, life for the Marik was quite difficult. You can see yourself on notes number D, paragraph D and E. Despite the high regard in which he was held, the Marik maintained tremendous humility. One of the leading rabbis of Italy, contemporary of the Marik, who immigrated to Italy from his native Germany, was Yehuda Mintz. As we see in paragraph F, both held each other in mutual respect. We've already touched upon the lives of Rav Yehuda Mintz and the other great rabbis of Germany who lived during this period in our previous lectures. The Marik passed away approximately in the year 1480. Torah on the highest level continued on in Italy with Rav Yehuda Mintz and his outstanding yeshiva in Padua. We have described the yeshiva's method of learning in our lecture about Polish Jewry in Pilpul. In the year 1509, Rav Yehuda Mintz was nifter, passed away, and the leadership was taken over by his son, Rav Avram. After his death in 1541, the mantle of leadership was taken on by Rav Avram's son-in-law, Rav Meir Katzenelnbogen of Padua, known as the Maram Padua, an early disciple of Yaakov Polak, and a distant cousin of Rav Moshe Israelis, the Rama, Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal. The Maram Padua reigned until the year 1565. He was followed by his outstanding son, Rav Shmuel Yehuda Katzenelnbogen. Despite all of its problems, Italy was truly blessed with great Torah scholars, and this is only a small sampling. During that same period, Germany, long a center of Torah scholarship, was experiencing steep decline, not from an Esav who came as Ochi, my brother, as in Italy, but as Esav in his true colors and open hatred. In the first half of the 16th century, German Jewry merited in having one of history's most unusual personages as its leader, a person who left us with a rich record of his life and times. His name was Rav Yosef ben Gershon Lowantz, known as Rav Yossel or Josselman of Rosheim. His story is the subject of the remainder of this lecture. Unfortunately, we do not have a detailed story of his genealogy. His name, last name Lowantz, the same name as that of the physician of Emperor Frederick III, suggests an origin in the French city of Lowantz. It has also been suggested he was related to the physician, but it is far from certain. We do know, however, that his family endured difficult times, which historians reconstructed from his own memoirs and the archives of the various German cities in which he and his ancestors lived. One thing about the Germans, they kept very meticulous records. Rabbi Yosselman's memoirs began with an incident that was told to him by his father, which is also recorded in the archives of various German cities, including Strasbourg and Frankfurt. The family of Yosselman's father, Gershon, and his uncles, Elias, and again from the German records, the other brothers called Eberlin and Merklin, had settled in the little town of Endingen, in what is today Switzerland, close to Alsace. One evening in the autumn of 1462, a migrant beggar family, a man, his wife, and two children, passed through this little town. The only ones in the village willing to give them shelter was this Jewish family. It was the night of Hoshana Rabbah. The migrants spent the night in the barn, and the Jewish family, together with several Jews from the adjoining village of Forsheim, spent the night in prayer. It's Hoshana Rabbah. 8 years passed by, and parts of four human bodies, a man, a woman, and two children, were found in the local cemetery. All indications were they were totally murdered with a plow iron. Rav Elias's neighbor, a Gentile butcher who owed the brothers a great deal of money, testified under oath that during the night of Hoshana Rabbah in 1462, he had heard loud noise and unearthly screams like those of children bled to death coming from the house of Rav Elias. Under agonizing torture, the brothers made the confession which the court desired. They had purportedly obtained blood from these murdered Christians for use in medicine for various ailments, as medication after circumcision. The verdict was handed down on April 4th, 1470. The accused were found guilty as charged. They were placed on dried cow skins, tied to the tails of horses and dragged through the various streets of the town to the execution site, a hill known to this day as Jews' Hill. There are no Jews there in that city. The four Jews of Forchheim were also met the same fate. The rest of the Jews of Endingen were banished from the area for all time. By the way, the bodies of the murdered beggar family were enshrined in the local St. Peter's Church and worshipped as miraculous relics by devout pilgrims. This is how Rav Yosef Rav Yosselman described the incident. And this is on page 4, section 2, paragraph A. In the year 5231, this is between 1470 and 71, the enemies of Endingen came to cast their net upon the three brothers, this is Elias, Eberlin, and Merklin, the uncles of my father, blessed memory. My father, blessed memory, with difficulty escaped with his life. The enemies submitted them to all kinds of torture. They were forced to make a false confession to the lying accusations of a scoundrel after bodies were found in a Christian cemetery. They were burnt to death for the sanctification of his name. The martyrs of Forchheim were also burnt to death at that time. The brother of my father-in-law was also condemned to be tortured on the wheel in the city of Haganah at that time. May his soul be bound in the bond of eternal life. From this incident and so many others like it, it is clear that confessions under torture are essentially worthless. A person driven to near insanity through relentless torture will often admit to the most outrageous lies just to stop the agony. It goes without saying life was not easy for Jews in Germany. It was difficult in peacetime, more so in times of war. Gershom, Rav Yosef's father, fled to Alsace, where settled Oberenheim in the lower Alsace, one of the 10 imperial towns of the area that was under the control of the German, or as he was commonly called, the Holy Roman Emperor. In those days, Charles, Duke of Burgundy, a vassal of France as well as the Reich, or the Holy Roman Empire, had illusions that he would reestablish the kingdom of Charlemagne's grandson Lothair, an area midway between France and Germany, from Italy on the south to the English Channel in the north. In 1476, the Swiss Confederate States joined together with the bishops of Basel and Strasbourg, the cities of Strasbourg, Schlettstadt, and Colmar, and the Duke of Lorraine to eventually defeat this Charles of Burgundy. During the war and its aftermath, the victorious Swiss wandered through Alsace, attacking Jews everywhere. Gersh and his wife were forced to flee Oberenheim with his wife and the other Jews. This is the story he told his son, Rav Yosef, and this is on page 5. It is quite appropriate to record what I heard from my father, blessed memory, how my father and mother, may they rest in Aden, together with their friends and their children, left the city of Oberenheim, together with other members of the countryside, and ran for their lives. And this is from the Swiss mercenaries during the Burgundian War of 1476 to 77. And he continues on. They remained in hiding in two fortresses, Hochbar and Lutzelstein, where they spent a whole year in hunger and thirst. It was the month of Teves, somewhere in December and January, and it was colder than it had been for a very long time, so the Jews could no longer seek shelter in caves and hiding places, and therefore sought lodging in and around Tuerkheim. It was then that the townspeople of Tuerkheim, enemies of the Jews, handed them over to the murderous Swiss. There were some 80 souls, men, women, youth, and maidens, all prepared to die. They cast themselves upon the ground to beg for mercy, that innocent blood be not spilled. At that time, God sent his help and his angel, who disposed the captain of the soldiers to have mercy. He said to them, quote, "If you bring 800 gold florins by noon tomorrow, I shall accept it as your ransom, 10 gold florins for each one of you." However, there was no Jew left in the territory, save one pious man, Yehuda Pamsa of Mulhausen. All the other Jews had been either destroyed or dispersed, slain or drowned or robbed of all of their possessions. Now when this pious man heard the evil tidings, he rent his garment, sat down on the ground, put on sackcloth and ashes, and all the people of his household did likewise. During that day and night he took or converted everything that he possessed and dispatched his servant Mordechai of blessed memory with a full amount of ransom money, 800 gold florins. The servant was delayed so that he did not arrive there before noon. Thus they were all led away, bound to a rope, rabbis, elders, women, youths and maidens. First the mercenaries seized one man whose name was Paneth of blessed memory, tearing the clothes from his body so they may cut off his head. They dealt likewise with the distinguished Rabbi Tzadik and similarly with all the others. We'll find later Rabbi Tzadik was a famous person in Germany. The people fell on their knees to confess their sins, and they bared their necks to the sword. The executioner now drew his sword to cut off their heads in succession, one after the other. At that moment the servant arrived and cried out, "Leave all those Jews alone! I have brought the money for the prisoners. Here it is." The ringleader took the 800 florins and permitted the Jews to enter safely into the house of Yehuda Pamsa of blessed memory. Paneth, the man who saw the sword he was about to sever his head, became mute from fright. Over a year and a half passed before he regained his health. The man who had redeemed them and protected them in his house until the danger had passed was delighted to have such an opportunity. The progeny of that pious man have without exception merited wealth and honor. The son of my sister, Yitzhak ben Yechiel of blessed memory, Pamsa, is a descendant of his. It is self-evident that someone who risks his life and capital to save souls and those about to be killed will merit to enjoy the fruits of his labor in this world, while the principle remains intact for him and his seed in the next world. I don't have the space to write even a tenth of the kindness that God miraculously wrought for those who were saved from that terrible decree, for he saved many families and people of distinction who are worthy of God's blessing, including my father and mother, and all the families of their friends and relatives, together with the other men, women, youths, and maidens. Because of the martyrs, did God repeatedly send his revenge against the Swiss. God is the God of vengeance, to revenge the blood of his servants. May it always be his will. Amen. After the war, the imperial cities of Colmar, Mulhausen, Kaiserberg, Schlettstadt, Rosheim, Oberenheim, and others met in conference and resolved to ban all Jews from their gates. They argued, at least they argued to the government, that if they would permit the Jews to return to their former homes after they were driven from them by the Swiss, they'd only be exposing them to new dangers. And one is reminded to what happened to the Jews of Poland who returned to their homes after the Holocaust. These cities, although technically owned by the Holy Roman Emperor, were since the year 1408 mortgaged to the Count Palatine. The Palatinate is an area astride the Middle Rhine that is now in the German states of Rhineland-Palatinate, Baden-Württemberg, and Hesse. The capital city of the Palatinate was the city of Heidelberg, the famous university. In those years, the Count served as the chief executive of Oberlandvogt of the imperial cities. This particular petition of the cities was brought before Philip, who was then the Count Palatine, who denied their request and issued explicit orders allowing the Jews to return. The city of Oberenheim, however, defied the Oberlandvogt and refused to let the Jews back. Gershon, who had lived in this city, Oberenheim, till then, was now forced to find a new home. One of the imperial towns that did not participate in this anti-Jewish conference was the city of Hagenau, the capital of the Reichslandvogte, the imperial government in Alsace, and the seat of the Unterlandvogt, the governor of the imperial cities. In other words, the titular head was the Count Palatine, but actually the one who ran, which is the day-to-day affairs, was this governor, the Unter, not the Ober, but the Unterlandvogt. Hagenau had a long history of tolerance for the Jews. It was in Hagenau, the hometown of Gershon's wife, Reislin, that Gershon settled, and in all probability Yosef was born in the following year, in 1478. We have no records of Rav Yosef's early years, where he studied, whose teachers were. We had mentioned in a previous lecture, in the lecture of the Marshal, one of the Luria family, Rabbi Yochanan Luria, who described that his whole Yichus brief, his whole genealogical records, were destroyed by the Swiss, referring to this Burgundian War. We know that he lived after the war, and it's quite possible a person that prestige who lived in that area perhaps had relations, you know, with that Reb Gershon's family. But again, it's all up in the air. In his early adult years, Rav Yosef lived in Mittelbergheim, a small town in the diocese of Strasbourg. Later, he moved to Rosheim. Between the years 1503 and 1505, Rav Yosef found himself in the middle of a war that pitted the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian, against the Count Palatine Philip. In the end, the emperor was victorious, and the ownership of the 10 imperial cities of Alsace was now transferred from the Count Palatine to the direct hands of the emperor. So whenever there were problems in that area, Rav Yosef could now go directly to the emperor, which really gave him an entree to the emperor. Rav Yosef too experienced hardships during that war, which was probably typical of the Jews at that time. This is what he wrote. I'll give you just a sense on the bottom of page 6. In the year 1503, 1504, 1505, many people fought against the Duke of Heidelberg. This is a Count Palatine, who the capital was Heidelberg. In the name of our Emperor Maximilian, they drove him out in disgrace from many fortresses and places. At that time, they looted and stole everything they could find in my possession, including all of the pledges for loans that I had made, as well as my household goods, more than 400 florins. I was only left with a few pieces in my possession and some outstanding loans that were made on trust without pledge. As any loans that were made on pledge, he couldn't collect. The person says, I gave you a pledge. I'm not responsible. I was also able to extricate from the teeth of the evil one, the evil, 140 gold florins of a superior value. Evidently, you see that there were various levels of purity, you know, of gold florins. This enabled me to support my family until Shvat of that year. Again, the historians looking at this are not clear what the significance of Shvat of that year. Is that when the war was completely over and life could go on? So may Hashem continue to work miracles and wonders day by day. May it always be His will. Amen. As you see, this is all from the memoirs. He was a very pious person. And it comes out through all of this. In the following years, Rav Yosef's leadership ability seems to have come to the attention of the Jewish community of Alsace. In the year 1510, he was appointed as a representative of that community. This is what he wrote in his memoirs in the top of page 7. In the year 1510, I was appointed together with Rabbi Tzadok the Prince, as he had been mentioned before in the previous story, and other men to keep watch over the community with particular care and to lead it. He maintained the position as representative of the Jews for the rest of his life. And just to give you a sense, this is a letter that Rav Yosef wrote to the government in the city of Hanau in 1539, as a paragraph B. Many years have passed since I, the impoverished one, was appointed to be their advocate before emperors and kings, electors and princes, and to lead them. I was chosen for this position by the entire Jewish community. Because of this, I was and still am responsible to act on their behalf in all of the imperial diets, in all of the palaces and courts of the emperors and electors when the need arises. This was secured by the power of the oath that I made. He maintained the position as representative of the Jews for the rest of his life. Over the years, his position expanded from the representative Alsatian Jewry to all of German Jewry. It is interesting to note that many of the official governmental documents of that time, specifically after 1530, Rav Yosef was recognized as the sole authority of the German Jewish community. He is called in official documents alternately Regent of all Jewry in Germany, or Commander of all Jewry of the German nation, or governor of all Jewry, or provost of all Jewry, or advocate of all Jewry. It was in different documents. That year, 1510, was a year of great challenge for German Jewry. This is how Rav Yosef described that year. This is on paragraph C of page 7. In that same year, in 1510, a calamity struck in the March of Brandenburg. The word March, or mark, means the border district. And the nobleman who controlled the mark was really one who had a strong army and was very powerful. As we're going to explain, the Graf, the Margrave of Brandenburg, was one of the seven electors, as we're going to say. When 38 innocent souls were burned in sanctification of his name in the city of Berlin. In addition, enemies and criminals from among our own people arose to destroy the written copies of the Oral Torah. God showed us a miracle within a miracle, for non-Jewish scholars arose to counter him and to restore the Torah to its former glory. The holy community of Frankfurt sacrificed their lives and fortunes till God saw our desperate plight and saved us from the plot of the apostate. This is what he writes in his memoirs. Another work that Rav Yosef wrote is called Sefer HaMikneh, an ethical work, which is also full of historical records, and we'll refer to it later, you know, throughout this lecture. In it he writes, "See what happened to that enemy of the Jews who was nicknamed Trefa Katziv, like the butcher of forbidden meats, Trefa meat. His name was Pfefferkorn, originally arose to become an informant against individuals in the community. Afterwards he fought with pious Jews in order to inform upon them and to cause them harm." This was his thesis, where he brings in a Sefer HaMikneh, that those Muslim, those informed against other Jews to the government, eventually became apostates. This led him to become an apostate. He then desired to cause grief to all of Israel and to destroy the Oral Torah and all of the holy books. God showed us a miracle within a miracle and sent that goodly non-Jewish scholar, Dr. Reuchlin, to defeat him in the presence of the Pope. He proved that it is improper to hide and confiscate the Talmud and our holy writings. The enemy received his rightful shame and he died in the city of Cologne. The destruction of the evil is a cause of rejoicing for the Jews. Pfefferkorn first appeared in southern Germany in 1504 and was converted to Christianity there together with his entire family. Eventually he moved to Cologne, where the Dominicans, especially the Dominican monk and scholar Ortwin Gratius, took an interest in him. On the advice of his patrons, Pfefferkorn published a series of writings in which he defamed the Jews, proposing they should be compelled to do hard and degrading labor, their holy books should be confiscated. In 1509, through the offices of the nun Kunigund, a sister of the Emperor Maximilian, Pfefferkorn obtained official authorization from the emperor to confiscate all Jewish books with the exception of the Bible. The Jews appealed to the Archbishop of Mainz, to the magistrate of the city of Frankfurt, and finally to the emperor himself. The effect of the monies paid by the Jewish community of Frankfurt, which is referred to by Rav Yosef in his memoirs, directly or indirectly led the emperor to ask the Archbishop of Mainz, to have the outstanding scholars of the day, especially Jacob Hochstraten, the inquisitor of the Dominicans of Cologne, and Johannes Reuchlin, remember we had mentioned him previously, Germany's best-known Hebraist, to study the books and decide whether or not they contain material that is dangerous to the Christian faith, as claimed by Pfefferkorn. As you recall, Dr. Reuchlin was very well disposed toward the Jews, and studied under Yaakov Yechiel Lowantz, the physician to the Emperor Frederick III, and under Ravadia Sforna. In the treatise, which he submitted to the emperor, he quoted Pico della Mirandola, who said, quote, "There is no art that can make the deity better known to us than the art of magic and the Kabbalah," end quote. Recklin further argued that the commentaries and grammar texts were essential for reading the Bible in its original language and for its correct interpretation. As for the Talmud, it was most difficult to explain to understand it. How could such an ignorant convert as Pfefferkorn even pretend to be familiar with this, quote, proud stag with many antlers, end quote? Judaism as such, continued Reuchlin, constituted no threat to Christianity. Quote, that the Jews do not recognize Yeshu as God as their own belief. They do not mean to insult anyone thereby, end quote. The matter did not end there. The Dominicans saw to it that the matter was brought before the ecclesiastical court of Mainz. There they ruled against Reuchlin's defense of the Jews and Jewish literature. Reuchlin appealed directly to the Pope, and this is the mention, the reference to here, the Pope. And after he made his case, Reuchlin was acquitted. What role, if any, did Rav Yossaman play in all of this is not clear, and no records of his participation exist. And there's been hypothesized, about his role. There's a novel by Marcus Lehmann about Rav Yossaman, and in it he has Rav Yossaman playing a substantial part, but there's no historical records. In the year 1515, Rav Yosef records the fact that he appeared before the Emperor Maximilian to defend the Jews of Alsace. This is what he wrote. In the year 1515, Ein Reish Hay, I was sent to our sovereign lord, the Emperor Maximilian of blessed memory, to lodge a complaint against the city of Oberenheim. The lords of Andlau and the Bishop of Strasbourg for planning to expel us from their territory. And this was a constant theme. Because of this, I was forced to travel there a second and third time. From that first court appearance to the end of his life, he was a frequent figure in the imperial court. In the period of unrest, after the passing of the Emperor Maximilian, Rav Yosef was still very much involved in ensuring the rights of the Jews of his area. And he describes here in paragraph B the problems of the Jews. You can read it yourself, what occurred to the Jews in the various cities now that the emperor was not there, and again they wished to expel all the Jews. After Maximilian died, this is in paragraph B, after Maximilian died, it was not clear who would be his successor. There were seven electors who determined the selection of the Holy Roman Emperor. There were the archbishops of Mainz, Cologne, Trier, the King of Bohemia, the Count Palatine of the Rhine, the Margrave of Brandenburg, and the Duke of Saxony. Each one carried the title elector. There were two candidates for emperor. One was King Francis I of France, and the other Charles I of Spain, the son of Philip of Burgundy, who was the son of Maximilian. After serious deliberations, Charles was elected and crowned as Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire. Through his mother, Juana, Charles already inherited the throne of Castile and Aragon, Naples and Sicily, parts of Africa and the New World. From his father, Philip, he inherited Burgundy and the Netherlands. And from his grandfather, Maximilian, he now inherited the Habsburg lands of Austria. As Holy Roman Emperor, was controlling all of Germany, he was now the most powerful king on earth. On page 9, Rav Yosef describes, again, his intervention in the royal court right after the crowning of the emperor. This is in the year 5280, top of page 9, 1519. Our sovereign lord, the Emperor Charles, began his rule. I and the man that was with me came before him and before his ministers to petition them on behalf of our people and our inheritance. We received privileges for all of Germany. Despite this, in that year, the townspeople of Rosheim and those that dwelt under the domain of Kaiserburg received official privilege to banish the Jews in their respective areas. Even though I was able, with God's help, to influence the emperor to totally revoke the expulsion decree of the domain of Kaiserberg, nonetheless, the official sanction to banish the Jews from Rüschheim was never revoked. By dint of untold effort, we succeeded in obtaining postponement again and again. To this very day, there has been no definite decision in this matter. Rav Yosef's diplomatic skills were not confined just with the governmental authorities. Before we go into the details of the next stories, it's important to have some understanding of the background. As we explained in the beginning of this lecture, the era from the 14th to the 16th centuries is often referred to as the Renaissance. Both aspects of the age, the return to art forms and aesthetics that had roots in the pagan Greek and Roman past, and the stress of the importance of the individual and his concerns, had enormous a part in the revolutionary changes that are associated with the 16th century. During this period, the popes launched an impressive building campaign to refurbish Rome, the capital of Western Christendom. It was during this period that Michelangelo painted the frescoes in the Sistine Chapel, which is part of the Vatican Palace. Raphael painted the stanza, the staterooms of that palace. Raphael's famous painting, The School of Athens, is part of that work. It was also during this period the reconstruction of the premier church of Roman Catholic Christendom, St. Peter's Basilica, was started. All of this work demanded enormous sums. There was a way for the church to raise such funds. At that time, the church would sell what they referred to as indulgences or rights to be forgiven. In other words, if sinners donated a certain amount to the church, they would be spared temporal punishment or punishment on this earth for those sins which they committed and later confessed to a priest. These sales brought in much revenue. Yeah, the Archbishop of Mainz, Albrecht of Brandenburg, sponsored such a sale in 1517 to pay the Pope for his appointment to Mainz and for the construction of St. Peter's in Rome. In other words, he told the Pope, if I'm elected, you get the money. He selected Johann Tetzel, a Dominican friar, to preach the indulgences and collect the revenues. Notice he gave the rushes, you know how wonderful it is. When Tetzel arrived in Saxony, Germany, something very unexpected happened. Martin Luther, an Augustine monk and professor of scripture at Wittenberg University in Saxony, who for many years had been very disturbed at the corruption and growing paganism of the church, and felt that the church had lost its direction, got up and posted his now famous 95 theses, or critical statements, on the door of the castle church at Wittenberg on October 31st, 1517. Although some of these theses directly criticized papal policies, they're put forward as tentative objections for discussion. Copies of the 95 theses were quickly spread throughout Europe and unleashed a storm of controversy. During 1518 and 1519, Luther defended his theology before his fellow Augustinians and publicly debated in Leipzig with the theologian Johann Eck, who had condemned the ideas of Luther. Meanwhile, church officials acted against him. The Saxon Dominican provincial charged him with heresy, and he was summoned to appear in Augsburg before the papal legate, Cardinal Cajetan. Refusing to recant, he fled to Wittenberg, and seeking the protection of the elector Frederick III of Saxony. When the Wittenberg faculty sent a letter to Frederick declaring its solidarity with Luther, the elector refused to send Luther to Rome, where he would certainly meet imprisonment or death. This was only the beginning for Luther. In 1520, Luther completed three now famous works in which he stated his views. In his address to the Christian nobility of the German nation, he invited the German princes to take the reform of the church into their own hands. By the way, it was very well received, and in a good part, if not most, of Germany, the nobility confiscated the church lands and declared a new era of reform. In a prelude, in the next work is a prelude concerning the Babylonian captivity of the church. He attacked the papacy and the current theology of sacraments. And in the quote, "On the Freedom of a Christian Man," end quote, he stated his positions on justification and good works. His studies had led him to the conclusion that Yeshu was the sole mediator between God and man, and not the church or any priest, and that forgiveness of sin and salvations are effected by God's grace alone, and are received by faith alone on part of man. In other words, there was no need to make confession before a priest, and no need to seal it with a monetary donation. This point of view turned him against scholastic theology, and this is of the Dominicans, which had emphasized man's role in his own salvation, and against many church practices would emphasize justification by good works, Maisim Toivim. The bull of Pope Leo X, Exsurge Domini, issued on June 15th that same year, gave Luther 60 days to recant. And Decet Romanum Pontificem of January 3rd, 1521, excommunicated him. Summoned before the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V at the Diet of Worms in April 1521, Luther again refused to recant and was put under the ban of the empire. He took refuge in the Wartburg Castle, where he lived in seclusion for 8 months. During that time, he translated the New Testament into German and wrote a number of pamphlets. By the time he came back to Wittenberg, the Reformation was firmly in place, and a short period of time had taken over a large part, if not most, of Germany. This anti-establishment fever carried itself over to the oppressed of the land, the poor peasants. All over Germany, the peasants took up arms against the local authorities. They robbed the churches of their gold and silver, their priceless manuscripts, and they ransacked the dwellings of the Jews. The leader of the peasant rebellion in the Alsace was one Erasmus Gerber of Molsheim. From his command post at the Altdorf Monastery, only a half mile from Rosheim, the home at that time of Rav Yosef, he directed the movement. All efforts by the civilian authorities and even the leaders of the Reformation Alsace, this is Martin Bucer and Wolfgang Capito, had no power over them. News had reached Rav Yosef that Gerber and his men were about to attack Rosheim. This is how Rav Yosef described what happened. This is on page 9, paragraph D. In the year 1525, there was turmoil caused by the peasants who had formed armies throughout all of Germany, the majority of them in the province of Alsace. The attempt to take control to swallow us up alive. The plague had already begun in some areas. Through God's mercy, I came to them, to the abbey called Altdorf, and there I won over their hearts through scripture and directed the leaders of the armies to publicly announce that the peasants should not lift up a hand against the Jews. In addition, many documents allowing free passage were issued for every city and state. Even though they later retracted and revoked their words and writings, still in all there was space and deliverance, like Reva Fatsola, that came about through this public pronouncement of theirs. This plague of theirs lasted until the Duke of Lorraine attacked them and killed many of them. In the other provinces they were slain and drowned by the thousands and ten thousands. Blessed be God who saved us from their hands and their evil plans. May he only continue to save us. Amen. This period was marked by economic change, and some of the reasons that made the peasants attack the Jews, their unpaid debts, also affected the small landowners and knights. It was this change of fortune that prompted the following incident recorded of Yosef's memoirs. By the way, before we read this, the Emperor Charles did not live in Germany on a regular basis. His home was in Spain. He visited once a year at the Reichstag, or Diet. The word Diet is from the word day, when all of the estates would come together to solve the problems that faced Germany. That's the Reichstag, and that's the Reich. During the interim, the regent was Charles' younger brother, Ferdinand. It was Ferdinand that Rav Yosef addressed his petition. And this is on page 10. In the year 1528, The landed nobility and the knights of the Unterland Vogtei of Hagenau arose and brought slanderous charges before King Ferdinand, may his majesty be exalted, and received permission from him to drive us out from the imperial territories, from all of the villages and some of the cities. They outnumbered and forcibly prevailed upon the Unterlandvogt, and he obtained a written order of expulsion from the king. All of the Jews of the province prevailed upon me to be their representative as I have been in the past. I complied with their request. Because of an accident that happened on the way to the horse I was riding, I made a firm commitment not to ride till I first came by foot to the palace of the king. He felt his efforts, his yesurim, his travail, would be a merit for him to be successful. With God's help, I succeeded in finding favor in his eyes, and he recalled the decree which he had issued to the knights and gave me documents reconfirming the rights of the Jews to settle in Alsace according to our privileges of the past. Even though they empowered me to spend up to 300 gold florins for expenses, I only spent 40 gold florins. The adversaries again decided to go back and stir up enmity and to undo what had been achieved. It was after he had come, you know, and received, you know, and accepted by the king. The king promised him, again, the anti-Semites came again. God, however, sent angels of destruction to the three principal plotters who fell victim to a sudden illness. The fourth fell into the hands of his own enemies at his residence. Hochfelden, and was put to death. The land has been quiet till this day. Again, he ends, blessed be Hashem, who has taken revenge upon our enemies and has saved us from their hands and the evil which they plotted against us. But you see, it was a constant battle. Since the year 1526, Ferdinand became king of Bohemia with his capital in Prague. So Rav Yosef made that long walk from Alsace, which is in the west of today's part of France, all the way to Prague, which is at the very east. Throughout Charles' reign, his greatest problem, aside from the rise of Protestantism, was the war with Turkey. The Turks had already swept over the Danube region and were actually laying siege to Vienna. It was because of the Turks and the need of the cooperation of the Protestant princes that the Catholic Charles could not really fight against the Reform movement, because he needed their goodwill. The Jews at that time were rumored as being traitors and spies for the Turks. As Charles was in Innsbruck, Austria in May of 1530, conferring with his brother, Ferdinand, Rav Yosef came to him there. This is what he wrote in his memoirs. In the year 1530, in paragraph F, a rumor spread and persisted among all the nations that the Jews were spying against the Germans and were reporting their findings to the Turks. These defamations also came to the attention of our sovereign lords, the king, this is Ferdinand, who was the king of Bohemia, and emperor, which is Charles. May their majesty be exalted. As a result, we were outlawed and denied admission to many lands. With the consent of the Jewish communities, I compiled and arranged a booklet to prove our innocence. I then came with God's help to the city of Innsbruck before the two sovereigns. This is Yosef Motzachein, and Yosef found grace, for they agreeably accepted the arguments for exoneration and reconfirmed all our privileges as of old. It wasn't easy. Later that year, in June, the Diet met in the city of Augsburg, and again Rav Yosef defended the rights of the Jews. It was in Augsburg that Rav Yosef set up rules and regulations for the Jewish community, setting for them a standard which the government found acceptable. In other words, the Jews were accused of usury, in other words, of really strangling the people with taking this as undue interest. It regulated these regulations that he put down, and eventually they were accepted by all German Jews, regulated the amount of interest that could be charged, and prohibited indirect usury by charging a higher price if the customer purchased the goods on credit. It placed limitations on accepting goods that may be stolen, because the person would give a pledge. Now, you don't know if the person really owns this or not. And there were problems that later on the true owner would come. And guidelines of enforcement. And here's what he writes in the bottom of page 10, paragraph G. In that year, 1530, the princes of the people, the officials and noble ladies without number, held a conference in order to adopt resolutions and ordinances. This was in 1530. This was in Augsburg. This was also a time that Charles had to grapple with the Protestant movement. And it was in Augsburg that the Protestants put together what is the Augsburg Confession, which is the official catechism of the confession of the Lutheran Church, which was composed by one of the leaders, Philip Melanchthon. The princes had in mind at a time to revoke the Jewish privilege of taking interest. I mean, without that, the Jews had no parnassa. They were deprived really of anything else. With God's help, I stood up in opposition and succeeded in having the ancient rights from the days of the Emperor Sigismund in 1433, reconfirmed by the Emperor Charles, in silencing our accusers and restoring peace to the land for the time being. And this was always a struggle. Just to give you a sense of why it was such a struggle, on page 11, again, this is again the next year, as he did it, in the year 1531, this is on page 11, the slanders came back to chase and pursue the emperor in Brabant. Brabant is what is in the area which now composes the north part of Belgium, the southern part of Netherlands, and Flanders, which is the southern part of Belgium, a land where there are no Jews. So wherever he went, at least he could find a minion. You know, he could be with other Jews. I was stirred by the concerns of the community to travel to those countries in order to stand in opposition and plead our cause with God's help. From the beginning of Adar until the beginning of Sivan, this is from February 18th to May 17th, 1531, I remained at the emperor's court to work for the common good. A knight by the name of Rotrart attempted to destroy me, but God in his great kindness sent his angel on my behalf to save me from his hand, from all those who attempted to entrap me. During that period, I entered the inner sanctum, the chamber of the emperor, and was adequately able to articulate to him my position. He favorably replied to my requests. In the interim, while I was free from public business and was alone in my room, I composed a work which is called Derech HaKodesh. By the life of the writer, I enjoyed those days of solitary contemplation. I thought to myself, fortunately, all of those men of the previous generation were able to concentrate their thoughts on higher concerns and distance themselves from the vanities of this world in order to involve themselves with spiritual pursuits. That war to save the Jews was fought on many fronts. Some of the worst accusers of the Jews were Jews themselves. We've already touched upon the incident of Pfefferkorn. Here is a similar incident in which Rav Yosef was personally involved. Here in the bottom of page 11, look at the destruction of the Jewish community of Regensburg. It all started with two informers, and this is his theme, that from those two informers who were the first to morally compromise the community became apostates. One of them together with all of his children, the other with his fiancée. Even though their fathers were descended from great men, nonetheless the severity of this crime of slander is such that even the merits of the fathers are of no benefit. The younger of the two tormented the entire diaspora through his use of the printing press. He expanded and built upon the previous heretical works in order to inject the poisonous venom that was seething within him. In the beginning of the 1500s, there was a convert, a Meshumet, by the name of Victor von Karben, who wrote a detailed work slandering the Jews. This fellow expanded on this work. He also slandered the Jews to the emperor. May his majesty be exalted with the following three charges. One, and this he came directly to the emperor. One, the Jews cursed the Gentiles. Two, they denigrate Yeshu in the prayer of Olenu L'Shabeach. You know, this charge was made in Spain as well. She'em mishtachem lehevel vorik, which is taken from most versions of Olenu. Vorik is the same numerical equivalent of Yeshu. Now, this is 316. So the claim was that just, you know, it's... this actually predated Christianity, of course, and the pasuk is taken from Yeshayahu. Three, the Jews circumcised converts. The emperor, filled with wrath, sent me a message that I must come without delay to answer the charges. Because of the kindness of the omnipresent, and the merit of the community, not my personal merit. He speaks, you see, this is his memoirs, he's a tremendous humility. He gave me the ability to express myself articulately, to refute the apostate decisively on the first day of the month of Av, 1530, and to thank God adequately defend the people of Israel. It was so successful, the apostate was sentenced to be put to jail and was forced to swear that he would leave the surrounding area. He went over to the faith of Luther, and he continued to be a thorn in our side. Actually, it was this fellow who it seems to be to a great partially responsible for Luther becoming a terrible anti-Semite. The name of this fellow, this person, he wrote a work called Das ganze jüdische Glaube, is the whole Jewish faith, was Antonius Margaretha. The family name was Margolis. His father was Rav Shmuel Margolis, who was the chief rabbi of Regensburg, his city. And his grandfather, it seems, was Rav Yaakov Margolis of Nuremberg, who was the Rebbe, the teacher of Rav Yaakov Polak, and was the one who put him in Cherem. And one wonders, again, the force of what an excommunication does. Of course, Rav Yaakov Polak did not accept it. In the history of his view, that Rav Yaakov Polak was correct in his view. Like what comes about from all these excommunications. One of the most colorful personages of this entire age was a short, robust, suntan Jew who surfaced in Cairo, Egypt, in Jerusalem in 1523, and later in Italy in the year 1524, who called himself David Ruveni, purportedly from the tribe of Ruvain, one of the 10 lost tribes. He claimed that he was the son of the late King Yosef and the brother of the present King Shlomo, who reigned over the land of Chabor in the Arabian desert, not far from the Red Sea. With over 300,000 subjects, all descendants of the ancient tribes of Ruvain, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, half of the tribe of Menashe, a free, warlike, and proud people. He also claimed he'd been sent on a secret mission to Europe to help his oppressed brethren. After being received with honors by the Jews of Italy, particularly by the Jewish refugees from Spain, he succeeded in enlisting the Pope's support for a secret plan, namely, to arm the Jews of Europe so they, together with the troops of his brother Shlomo, would wrest control of the Holy Land from the Turks. Armed with a letter of introduction from the Pope and bearing an ample supply of money and gifts from the Jews of Italy, Ruveni, accompanied by a great entourage and proudly displaying the ancient banner of Yehuda Maccabee, sailed to Portugal to request ships, guns, and ammunition for King John III. He might have succeeded, but his presence caused such an uproar amongst the Muranos of Portugal that the so-called emissary from the land of Chabor was politely requested to leave Portugal. But it cannot be said that his trip was without success. Diogas Pires, secretary to Portugal's High Court of Justice, a noble, talented, and handsome youth of a well-known Murano family and a friend and confidant to the king's household, was very touched by all of this. Perez fled Portugal to Turkey and then to Tzfas, Safed, in Eretz Yisrael, and openly embraced Judaism. He joined a group of Mekubolim of Kabbalists, and he claimed that a Maggid, an angel, had come to him and foretold that Mashiach would come in the year 1540. When German mercenaries under Charles V sacked Rome in 1527, it seemed to him a sign that Edom, Esau, Rome, was falling, and the hour of Jewish redemption was at hand. He hurried to Italy to announce the imminent coming of Mashiach. There in Italy he met David Ruveni once again. After seeing the Pope, they came together to see the Holy Roman Emperor in the year 1532. This is what Yosef wrote about their coming. He called himself, by the way, as Diogas Pires, he gave himself the name Shlomo Malcho. By that time, in 1532, an Italian, or we put in parentheses Portuguese, a righteous convert by the name of Rabbi Shlomo Molko, may rest in Aden, came with an extraordinary idea to stir up the emperor by telling him that he had come to summon all the Jews to fight against the Turks. When I heard of his plans, I wrote him a letter warning him against stirring up the heart of the emperor, lest he be destroyed by the great fire. I left Regensburg so the emperor could not say that I had a hand in this scheme. As soon as he came to the emperor, he was put in chains and brought to Bologna. There he was burned at the stake in sanctification of the name of God and the faith of Israel. He delivered many people from sin. May his soul rest in the Garden of Eden. Why did Charles condemn him to death? This is the subject of historic debate. It seems we have from other historical sources that Shlomo Malka had a private audience with the king and spoke to him some 2 hours. And there are all kinds of theories. From Yoselman's chronicles, it would seem that he simply considered him a dangerous madman. Others connect his death with his messianic predictions and the undermining of the current order, which in all likelihood would lead to rioting and rebellion. The fact that he was burned at the stake is actually not remarkable, as Perez was baptized. It was a Marano. And according to church doctrine, was subject to the death penalty for the heresy of abandoning Christianity. It seems, you know, David Ruvaini was taken in chains to Spain by Charles, it's not all that clear, and died there in prison. Because after this, we hear nothing about David Ruvaini. He is Eve. Yoselman does not even bother to mention him at all. Perhaps his historians claim he felt that such an imposter did not deserve mention. Malko, on the other hand, who became a Baal Tshuva, and who positively influenced many, deserved at least an honorable mention. Of all the difficult situations Rav Yosef found himself in, the most difficult seems to have centered around bringing peace amongst the Jews themselves. In the year 1492, Rav Yeshaya, descendant of Rav Zerachia Halevi, the Baal HaMor, the author of the Sefer HaMor, left Spain and settled in Bohemia. With the monies he managed to take with him from Spain, he purchased the village of Horowitz, or Horowitz, adjacent to the city of Prague. All the Horowitzes are descended from that man. He was a wealthy and generous man and a scholar who was close to the government. He had 7 sons, and after his death in the year 1514 or 1515, they started taking a dominant role in the city of Prague. The oldest son was Aaron Meshulam, who was known as Zalman Munka. He was the wealthiest man in Prague. One of Zalman Munka's brothers was of Shabsai Sheftel, whose son Rav Avram was a disciple of Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal. His son, in turn, was Rav Yeshaya Halevi, the author of the Shnei Luchos HaBris, known as the Shiloh HaKodesh. It seems that Zalman Munka, together with other members of his family, gained control of the internal Jewish government in Prague against the wishes of many of the community's members. Rav Yosef describes in great detail on page 13 how he was able to enact peace, but with great difficulty. And because of time, I can't, you'll have to read the notes yourself. As we mentioned before, false accusations and confessions under torture were not uncommon. The following incident that happened in the year 1535, however, is surely one of the strangest. It also shows the lengths that Rav Yosef was willing to go to save his fellow Jews. In the year 1534, Avram Hirsch of Leubschitz, the senior elder of Yag Ferndorf, had obtained from the Margrave of Silesia a permit to engage in the spice trade, which had heretofore been forbidden to the Jews by the Gentile trade guilds. Shortly thereafter, a young woman who had been condemned to death because of witchcraft and prostitution testified in court that one day Avram Hirsch had asked her to obtain for him milk from the breast of a Christian woman so that he may derive from his magical powers with which to kill all Christian women in the land. Instead, according to her testimony, she brought him pig's milk. Hirsch had had the milk poured into the cloven skull of a criminal who had died on the gallows. When there came forth a great squealing from the skull as there are little piglets therein, end quote. This is really from the German, this is the archival records from the German courts. The woman related. Avram became very angry at her for the fraud, for now it had only magical power to kill pigs, not women. Although he emphatically denied that he had committed this absurd crime, he was thrown into prison and tortured. Under continuous torture, he pleaded guilty, they would stop torturing him, and named several other Jews as his accomplices. And they say stop, he admitted, and they kept on the torture. However, even under torture, the Jews that he named refused to admit anything. Finally, when Avram Hirsch was tied to the stake before his death, he loudly retracted his confession. As a result of this incident, the Jews of Silesia were all thrown into prison, and nobility and the populace of Silesia were putting pressure on the Margrave to have them expelled. And here on page 14, on top of this, Rav Yosef describes in detail how he made the trek all the way, to the Margrave of Silesia, to plead on behalf of the Jews. He says, I spent over 600 gold florins in order to prove and to persuade the prince, the Margrave George, that we as well as the rest of Israel are innocent of this crime and slander. For Yosef, you realize this was a major trip. Just to put in perspective, Alsace, we said before, was the westernmost part of Germany, today's part of France. Silesia was the easternmost part, today is part of Poland. Despite all the difficulties involved, Rav Yosef's concerns were with all of a German Jewry. Probably the most influential person in all of Germany, with perhaps the exception of the emperor himself, was Martin Luther. We have previously touched upon his early career. Rav Yosef did not know him directly as he lived in Saxony, far from Rav Yosef's native Alsace. He only knew him by reputation. In the year 1523, Luther published a booklet, quote, that Yeshu was born a Jew. In it, he pointed out the great religious figures who passed down Christianity were born Jews. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Samuel, Shmuel, David, Daniel, Paul. And he recommended that Jews be treated with kindness. Luther had taken Reuchlin's side when he began his defense of the Jewish books, and had spoken out against the ritual murder libel and cautioned against forcing Jews to accept baptism. It only made sense that when the elector John Frederick of Saxony enacted a mandate to strictly forbid Jews from settling, doing business, even traveling through his land, the Rav Yosef would appeal to Luther to use his influence to protect the Jews. Before leaving his native Alsace, Rav Yosef obtained letters of recommendation from the leading Protestant leaders of Alsace, Wolfgang Capito and Martin Bucer, and the municipality of Strasbourg, one of the leading Protestant cities. Since publishing his booklet in 1523, however, Luther had a change of heart vis-a-vis the Jews. In 1537, he had become a most rabid of all anti-Semites. Evidently, he saw that being friendly to the Jews, the Miyad Ochi, did not convert them, so he tried the other tack, Miyad Esav. His subsequent works were filled with such hatred that they were an inspiration for Adolf Hitler. I just don't want to burden you just quoting from Luther. Rav Yosef at that time was not aware of Luther's change of heart. He attempted to have an audience with Luther, but he refused to see Rav Yosef and wrote him a stinging letter in reply. I mean, that letter is extant. Again, time doesn't allow to quote the letter. In retrospect, Rav Yosef felt that Luther himself was behind the expulsion of Jews from Saxony. And this is how Rav Yosef described the event. In the year 5297, 1536, the Prince Herzog Hans von Sachsen, the Elector John Frederick of Saxony, was about to take away our rights and forbid any one of the people of Israel to travel within the confines of his land. He did this through the influence of the minister, the priest, who called himself Martin Luther. Luther is the Lo Tohar. Lutar. His soul and body are bound in hell, for he wrote books, many books of heresy, which constantly fell from his lap, which stated that he who helps a Jew will lose all hope of salvation. This is what he later wrote. Through his many anti-Semitic works, the princes and the nations were so affected the people of Israel were in grave danger. Through the permission of our rabbis, I was able to acquire supportive letters from other non-Jewish Protestant scholars in the city of Strasbourg. I attempted to meet with the Prince of Saxony in the territories of Meissen and Thuringia, but I was unsuccessful. Finally, he came to the city of Frankfurt, and this was in 1539, together with the other princes, especially the Prince of Brandenburg, who planned as well to expel all the Jews. Then I was able to present them as a result of public debate, in which I engaged the Protestant non-Jewish scholars to prove to them the incorrectness of their position of Luther and Bucer and their followers based on the words of our Holy Torah. In other words, he came in from the lion's den, really in the midst of all the great Protestant scholars, and defended the Jews successfully. As a result, they agreed to the correctness of my position, a miracle within a miracle, occurred to us when it became known to the public as well as to the Margrave Joachim, that all of the martyrs who were burned at the stake during the lifetime of his father in the year 1510, we had mentioned this before in Berlin, 38 Jewish souls were falsely and maliciously accused, for the thief had already retracted his original false confession, which had falsely maligned the Jews, and an evil enemy and villain, the Bishop Jerome, had commanded the priest who heard this retraction as part of the final confession of the criminal not to relate the confession of the thief to the prince. In other words, he had confessed that the Jews were innocent. The priest went to his superior, the bishop, and the bishop said, "Don't you dare." In other words, the Jews have to be killed. Because of this, the princes retracted from their evil and granted the Jews free passage throughout their lands. To this day, does Prince Joachim stand by his word? The Prince of Saxony, however, went back on his promise and treated as terribly as people without rights. Therefore did God cause him to be humbled, nor did he receive his just deserts. Blessed be God who wrought vengeance on our behalf. And here I quote, here in the next, from a letter of consolation which Rav Yosef wrote to the Jews of Alsace, that it was Dr. Philip Melanchthon. You know, his name was, well, it started off, his name was Schwarz Erd, black dirt. And he changed it, made it fancily, says, in Latin, this is Melanchthon. Presented compelling evidence to the great and exalted noble Margrave Joachim II of Brandenburg, how the Jews were unjustly burned at the stake. And he goes on, tells the story. And that priest, it would seem he became a Protestant in the interim, lives in Württemberg, and you can go and ask him yourself. Again, how difficult it was to ensure the safety of the Jews of Germany under normal circumstances was doubly so in times of war. There was, in the following passages, again, we don't have time to read them, but in the year, it started really in 1546. I mean, this is just, unfortunately, I just don't have the time to read all the material. The emperor went to war against two of the Protestant princes, the princes of Saxony and Hesse. Now, the Protestants, under the influence of Luther, wanted the Jews to be destroyed, and there was a tremendous fear if they would be successful, they would be successful. But the emperor was terribly outnumbered. He only had some 40,000 troops against 100,000 of the Protestant princes. And those 40,000 were Spanish troops, and he had to intervene, and this is on page 17, on behalf of the Jews, to make sure the Spanish troops treat the Jews with dignity, which Yossel was successful at that. That the Spaniards treated the Jews, and the Jews in turn fed the Spaniards. But they were outnumbered, but he describes a miracle that Charles was successful and the Protestants were defeated. If the Protestants would win, and under Luther's influence, they would utterly destroy the Jews. And as a result, actually, Charles, a Catholic, was successful. He describes he actually was in Frankfurt, and Frankfurt was a city which sided with the Protestants. And maybe we just on the minutes is on page 18. This is where his memoirs end. In December of the year 1546, Our sovereign lord, the emperor, sent his general together with an army of tens of thousands against the city of Frankfurt in order to subdue it. He also instructed them to allow them to peaceably surrender if they would be willing to accept his conditions. The Jewish community of Frankfurt sent me a communication, asked me to intercede on their behalf before the commanding general, Count Maximilian von Buren. The city was conquered, and the city's gates were open to the count and all of his armies. I came to the count and made my presentation and gave him a gift worth a total value of 800 gold florins. Nothing went without gifts. As a result, there was peace in the Jewish section. The entire city was safe for the Jews. What the mercenaries had looted and plundered in Furchtwagen in Darmstadt, they in turn sold to the Jews at a very reduced price. The result, the Jews were able to make from this a goodly amount of money. Thank God their prayers were heard and their mourning turned into joy because they were afraid that the Protestants would be successful. In such a manner, may God extend peace to all of the Jewish people. And again, from the Sefer HaMikneh, again, he goes in great length to describe what had occurred in the bottom of page 18. Rav Yosef died in late March or early April of 1554 in the midst of efforts to prevent the Jews of Dagonsheim from being expelled. His whole life was spent saving Jews. By the way, he was a tremendous scholar. He wrote four works. We've quoted from some of them. He wrote the memoirs. He wrote Sefer HaMikneh, which is really a Musar Sefer. It's a book on Jewish philosophy. It is based to a great degree on Sefer Derech HaMunah by the Spanish philosopher Avraham Vibago, but also contains much historical material from which we draw upon. I just want to explain, since it was very difficult getting the original material to compile this lecture. A scholarly edition of Sefer Mikneh was published in the year 1970 by Professor Chava Frankel Goldschmidt. In 1996, Professor Goldschmidt published the Zichronos, the memoirs. There were very few editions of this book in the entire country. Fortunately, the University of Michigan had one copy. I'd like to give special thanks to my wife for her tireless efforts in able to get the material here for this lecture. He also wrote Yikundas Derech HaKodesh, which was not preserved except for two passages, which were by the great Talmud Chacham Rav Yosef Hahn in his work Yosef Ometz. Here he quoted from Ram Rutenberg, who said, "Those who died by the stake, Al Kiddush Hashem, did not feel the suffering." It's a tremendous chesed, kindness of God. He left a tremendous family. His son Moshe was a great scholar. Moshe's son Eliyahu Lawans was a famous Mekubal, a Kabbalist, and served as chief rabbi of the cities of Friedberg and Worms. He was known as Rev Eliyahu Baal Shem. I'd like to end this lecture with a memorial of Rav Yosef as recorded in the memorial books of Niederheim and Hagenau. May God remember the soul of the venerable prince. Our teacher, Yosef Ben Gershon, of blessed memory, was called by the name of Yoselman, together with the souls of Avram Yitzchak V'Yaakov, because he spared neither his honor nor his property, and oftentimes risked his life to intercede for the protection of the community and of individuals. For a period of over 40 years, he attended to the courts of kings and princes and kept expulsions, oppression, persecution, and murder far from the Israelite nation. He also obtained letters of protection at the court of the emperor, may his majesty be exalted. For all of this, he accepted neither favors nor rewards. He did it solely for the love of God and of Israel. May his portion, therefore, be with the other shepherds and princes in Israel. May his soul be bound up in the bond of eternal life with the other pious in Gan Eden in paradise. Amen.